This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, I'm Ted Weil. Thanks for joining me today and welcome back to All About History, a quarterly periodical from Great Britain. So let's dive in. We're starting today with a regular feature about art exhibits, this one, Golden Mummies, Reconsidering Egypt's Mummies and History in a New Context. Since 1912, the Egyptian Gallery at Manchester Museum has been delighting visitors with an array of artifacts and objects from across Egypt. Much of the exhibit was acquired from the Egyptian site of Hawara during a time when British explorers and archaeologists were preoccupied with collecting antiquities from across the colonies. Today, the museum's mission is to use these pieces to challenge and interrogate imperialism and colonialism. With Manchester Museum reopening after a £15 million refurbishment, the Egyptian collection is available to view in a new exhibition. Golden Mummies of Egypt explores Egyptian history from the Greco-Roman period and features artifacts that showcase Egypt's multicultural heritage. As the first international touring exhibition from the museum, it has attracted over 450,000 visitors during its stretch in both the U.S. and China. Dr. Campbell Price, the museum's curator of Egypt and Sudan, says, quote, "Originally, these extraordinary objects were considered within the Victorian context in which they came to the museum. Our exhibition aims to highlight how this history has informed pervading modern interpretations of life and death during an era when Egypt was part of the Greek and Roman worlds," end quote. Here are some of the items in this exhibit. The Gold Mummy of a Child. This mummy of a young girl was discovered at the site of Hawara and dates to the 1st century CE. The gold gilt was intended to imitate the radiance of the gods in the hope of resurrection. A portrait panel. A painted portrait panel, like the one here dating to the reign of Hadrian, were a common decoration on Egyptian mummies from the Roman period, 1st to the 3rd century CE. Much like earlier mummy masks, these portraits helped mummified bodies retain their identity. An Assyrian helmet. An Assyrian-style copper alloy helmet discovered in western Thebes suggests that at some point the area was invaded by the Assyrians. The presence of the helmet, according to archaeologist Flinders Petrie, shows a violent reality for Egyptians of the period. Cartonnage covering. This artifact from Hawara is an example of cartonnage, the layering of papyrus or fibers to cover a mummified body. As seen in the object, cartonnage provided a smooth surface onto which motifs were painted to create elaborate and beautiful designs. Rebirth after death. A possibility discovered in the town of Kaharga Oasis, this is the upper part of the cartonnage of a woman's mummy. This cartonnage was designed to highlight the woman's sexuality in the hope that it would aid rebirth after life. A mummy mask. The styled curled hair and earrings present on this artifact indicate that it was a mask made for a mummy of a woman. It was discovered in Lahun, an Egyptian village excavated by archaeologist Flinders Petrie in the late 19th century. A gilded mask. Though this mask has been restored in more modern times, it's a striking example of a gilded mask for an Egyptian mummy. The mask of a man features a headdress with painted pharaonic deities on its side. Terracotta figurines. Depicting a woman, perhaps a female deity, with a sedan being carried by two male attendants, this terracotta figurine was found at Hawara. Many terracotta figures, like this one, have been identified as having Hellenistic features, showing Greek influence in Egypt. And now we move on to another regular feature, some reviews of books, TV shows, and films causing a stir in the history world. Lady Chatterley's Lover, directed by Laure de Clermont Tonnerre. D.H. Lawrence's 1928 novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, has always been a controversial tome. In Britain, it was the subject of an obscenity trial, and publisher Penguin was forced to prove the book was of literary merit. Penguin won the case and is considered something of a landmark moment in the history of British publishing. But in the United States, Australia, India, Japan, and Canada, this raunchy tale of an upper-class lady's affair with a servant was banned. Now, Laure de Clermont-Tonnerre, director of the 2019 film The Mustang, has helmed a new and inspiring version of the tale. She certainly prioritizes style over substance, though the script, by David McGee, is solid and entertaining enough. Clermont-Tonnerre fills the screen with intoxicating images, particularly emphasizing the beauty of nature versus the dark and dank interior of the mansion. Isabella Summers' soundtrack, while occasionally intrusive, is highly engaging. Summers mixes an eclectic variety of styles, from the unusual violin themes appropriate to a period piece, to sounds that wouldn't be out of place in a horror film, all to mesmerizing effect. Combined with Benoit Delhomme's gorgeous cinematography, they create a unique, almost folk feel that adds an exhilarating freshness to this adaptation. Of course, due to its source material's scandalous history, with any new version, attention is immediately going to be drawn to its depiction of sex. Clermont-Tonnerre has approached these sequences with the care of a master painter, and many of the shots wouldn't look out of place in a gallery. They are erotic, beautiful, and strangely freeing, managing to visualize the story's rich themes. Emma Corwin, perhaps best known for her portrayal of Princess Diana in Netflix's The Crown, plays the titular Lady Chatterley. Corwin recently appeared in the disappointing My Policeman, but fares much better here. Although the film is most certainly a romance, McGee's screenplay also puts a great deal of focus on Chatterley's growing disillusionment with the British upper class, giving Corwin a number of meaty scenes and moments. Corwin throws herself into the part with a powerful and believable energy. Jack O'Connell, as Oliver Mellors, gets significantly less to do, but manages to portray Mellors as an object of desire in his few scenes. Matthew Duckett is intensely unlikable as Clifford, but manages to keep the character, and therefore his various evils, intensely human, without turning him into a caricature. Jolie Richardson, who previously played Chatterley herself, is one of the standouts as Mrs. Bolton. Admittedly, it could be accused of dragging in a few moments, but the film has a hypnotic power that draws you in and holds you. The cast do a superb job, but it is Clermont-Tonnerre's direction, Delhomme's cinematography, and Summers' score that are the real standouts. Lady Chatterley's Lover is an exceptional adaptation of a classic and important work of English literature. Arcadian Days, an innovative retelling of some ancient Greek myths. Ancient Greek mythology has captivated audiences for millennia. The fantastical stories of gods and goddesses, titans and nymphs, heroes and monsters, which were so real to the Greeks who worshipped the Olympian pantheon, have achieved longevity right through to the present day. In his new book, playwright and novelist John Sperling has taken five pairs of Greek mythology's greatest figures and delved into their stories to create a compelling retelling of some of the most well-known tales. Sperling splits the book into sections, taking the male-female pairs of Prometheus and Pandora, Jason and Medea, Oedipus and Antigone, Achilles and Thetis, and Odysseus and Penelope as the title characters for each chapter. He dissects the myths and legends associated with these characters and explores stories like Prometheus's punishment from Zeus, the journey of Jason and the Argonauts, and the voyages of Odysseus within the broader context of the lives of these figures. In his almost conversational style, Sperling entices the reader into this magical world. His expert knowledge of the Greek legends shines as he guides us through not only the myths, but also the historiography, with which he highlights the inconsistencies and evolution of the stories over time. Sperling also effortlessly weaves his personal musings on history, poetry, drama, and human nature, which allows the reader to analyze and look at these stories from a new perspective. For those interested in ancient Greece and mythology, it is certainly a book that needs to be added to your reading list. When Russia Did Democracy: A Political History of Russia, From Medieval Russia to Putin. This reflection on the many instances, large and small, of a democratic process being brought to the people of Russia over the centuries is timely and concise. From the medieval Rus to Vladimir Putin, McInnes seeks to offer an overview of Russian history through its ballot boxes, parliaments, referendums, and constitutions. There are two key ideas that seem to have fueled this book for McInnes. The first is learning in school about the Russian Revolution and the single day that the Constituent Assembly sat before being closed by the Bolsheviks in 1918 as a singular experiment in democracy. The second is the often repeated idea that Russia is ill-suited to democracy. McInnes offers multiple examples of the many attempts by Russia and its neighboring states to implement democratic processes of one kind or another. In some cases, they were well ahead of Western democracies. Russian women voted in 1917, a year before their right to vote in the UK, and 3 years before the USA. What we also see is the strong association between regional, national movements and democracy, particularly in the later Soviet era. We close on the period McInnes got to witness firsthand, living and working in Russia, of the rebuilding work in the 1990s and the rise of Putin in the early 2000s. Those hoping for a deep dive into Putin's politics might be disappointed. While this story closes the book, its main focus is on what came before, pointing to the paths not taken and the opportunities squandered. And finally, Norse myths that shape the way we think. How many of us are really familiar with the Norse myths of old? It would perhaps be fair to argue that not many. Sure, we know the names of Loki and Thor, but is it fair to suggest that most people first conjure images of Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston when they hear those names? Upon reading Caroline Larrington's new book, you might find that you recognize more of these ancient Norse legends than you would first think. The book follows on from a number of Myths That Shape the Way We Think titles published by Thames and Hudson, including works focusing on Greek and Roman legends. In the latest in the series, Norse myth expert Larrington seeks to explore how the Norse myths have been reimagined over the centuries, touching on everything from George R. R. Martin's White Walkers to the storming of the U.S. Capitol building in 2021. Some of these associations, particularly the latter, might, to the uninitiated, at first seem like something of a jump, but Larrington makes her points eloquently. She chooses to structure the book myth by myth, usually first examining the narrative and then exploring chronologically how the myth itself, or elements of it, have been reinterpreted over time. Even at the conclusion, when bringing in the climate crisis, her arguments are sound and compelling. Larrington is no stranger to exploring the historical origins of fantasy. A self-confessed Game of Thrones fan, her previous book, Winter is Coming, delved deep into the medieval-inspired world of the popular book and television series. She has also previously written extensively about Norse myths, authoring A Critical Companion to Old Norse Literary Genre and The Norse Myths, A Guide to Viking and Scandinavian Gods and Heroes, among others. Larrington's expertise is apparent from the outset, and her knowledge of the subject is staggering. Her prose style is light and certainly not academic, making the Norse myths that shape the way we think instantly accessible to readers unfamiliar with the topic. However, this does not mean that her writing is simplistic. Far from it. And her discussion is highly intelligent and considered. There is a wealth of beautiful illustrations, 99 in total, both full color and black and white. These range from 19th century paintings to images of historical artifacts to stills from the Marvel epic Thor Ragnarok. Some of these are more impactful than others, with the infamous picture of Jake Agnelli from 2021's political turmoil in the U.S. adding immensely to that particular argument's weight. The Norse Myths That Shape the Way We Think is a compelling examination of the power and influence of these ancient legends and the continuing effect they have on contemporary society and culture. Touching on a surprisingly wide array of topics, Larrington manages to present her arguments in an intelligent yet accessible manner. Sure to please anyone with even a passing interest in mythology, this is an interesting and engaging piece of work. And now, History versus Hollywood, Facts versus Fiction on the Silver Screen. Lost City of Z. Was Percy Fawcett the heroic explorer of this film, or a foolhardy fanaticist? The verdict? The overarching details are correct, but are played heavily for dramatic effect. Item number one, the film follows Percy A. Fawcett, Charlie Hunnam, and his search for a city in the Amazonian rainforest he dubbed Z. It depicts him as initially reluctant to give up military glory for work as a surveyor. In reality, he'd been in the Royal Geographic Society since 1900. Point two, it shows three expeditions taken by Fawcett between 1906 and 1925, but he actually made eight. One was with James Murray, the polar explorer, who is accurately shown accusing Fawcett of leaving him to die in the jungle when he couldn't keep up. Number three, Fawcett gives a speech about the possibility of an early South American civilization where he defends the native communities. This speech is fictional, and Fawcett, while more respectful of the Amazonian tribes, was still racist and condescending in his writing. Number four, the film shows Nina wanting to join her husband on his expeditions, but being refused. This appears to be a genuine wish of hers, not least because she believed in the equality of women and was well-educated, speaking multiple languages. And number five, Fawcett is depicted as reluctant to go on the last mission, but is persuaded by his son Jack, played by Tom Holland. In fact, he recruited his son and Jack's friend, Raleigh Rimmel, who is not shown in the film. They vanish 5 months into their trip and are never found. And that brings us to the end of an issue, but we have some time left, so we will dive into the next issue of this publication. We'll start, as we always do, with a couple of defining moments. March 12, 1994, the UK's first female priests. At Bristol Cathedral, a service was held to ordain the first female priests in the Church of England. The group consisted of 32 women, and the first to be ordained was Angela Berners Wilson, thus becoming the first female priest in the UK. The service was controversial, with many members of the clergy, as well as parishioners, threatening to leave the church due to the decision to allow women to join the priesthood. March 4, 1933. Frances Perkins is appointed to the American cabinet. Appointed as Secretary of Labor by Franklin D. Roosevelt on March 4, 1933, Frances Perkins became the first woman to serve in a cabinet position in the U.S. government. This accomplishment was marked by Time magazine when she appeared on its cover in August of 1933. Perkins held her post for 12 years, becoming the longest serving of Roosevelt's delegates. And now we move on to a longer article, all about the British Empire. First, some key events. 1663, royal approval granted for Britain to begin trading in slaves. A royal charter is granted to the Company of Royal Adventurers of England trading into Africa. Issued by Charles II, this is the moment when the transatlantic slave trade formally begins. Around 630,000 Africans are forced into slavery between this year and 1700. 1775, the American Revolution begins. Following years of unrest, the American Revolution begins with the battles of Lexington and Concord. 7 years of fighting follow, with a major American victory occurring at the Battle of Yorktown in 1781. 2 years later, the Treaty of Paris ends the conflict. As disease was responsible for a high number of battlefield deaths, George Washington ordered smallpox inoculations for his troops. John Hawkins and the Slave Trade, 1562. John Hawkins paves the way for what will essentially be the slave triangle used in the slave trade. Elizabeth I sponsors some of his expeditions. Britain captures Jamaica, 1655. At the behest of Oliver Cromwell, a British expedition sets sail for Jamaica and takes control of the island from the Spanish. In 5 years, all Spanish forces have been defeated. British settlements established across the globe, 1670. Settlements have been founded in North America and the West Indies. From this decade forward, settlements can also be found in Canada after the Hudson Bay Company established itself there. The East India Company is formed in 1600. The East India Company is formed to share the spice trade. During the 18th and 19th centuries, its power in India increases, and it becomes a powerful political force. First British trading post established on the African continent, 1661. British forces capture an island from the Dutch and rename it James Island. This becomes the first British trading post on the African continent. The Battle of Plassey, 1757. East India Company forces, led by Robert Clive, face the last Bengal in India, Siraj ud Dola. Clive goes on to serve twice as governor of Bengal and works to solidify the East India Company's power in the country. 1788, the first convicts arrive in Australia. The first convicts sent to Australia arrive in Botany Bay. The Industrial Revolution has led to a surge in crime, and transportation is introduced to solve the problem of what to do with Britain's prisoners. Over the next 80 years, some 160,000 convicts are transported. 1857, the Indian Rebellion. Indian sepoy troops rise up against British forces in India. These events lead to the abolishment of the East India Company in 1874, with the British Crown instead taking control of rule in India. The army is reorganized to reduce its reliance on Indian troops. 1997, Hong Kong handover. After 156 years of British rule, sovereignty is returned to China. The agreement has one country, two systems policy, which maintains that social and economic elements of Hong Kong are supposed to remain unchanged for 50 years. Beijing's new security laws have seen protests in Hong Kong against China. The Boston Tea Party, 1773. Colonists, furious at Britain for increased taxation, protest by hurling 342 chests of tea into Boston Harbor. This is a key event on the road to the American Revolution. The British occupy Hong Kong, 1841. As part of the Opium Wars, Britain attacks China and occupies Hong Kong. In 1841, the island is formally ceded to the British. Mau Mau Uprising, 1952. Kenya's largest ethnic group, the Kikuyu, are increasingly victimized by laws favoring white settlers. Militant action to reclaim land lost begins, and the British impose a violent crackdown. Slavery abolished, 1833. Slavery is abolished in most British colonies. Some 800,000 slaves are freed as a result, but the act does not refer to British North America. British Commonwealth of Nations, 1931. In 1926, the Balfour Report states that Britain and its dominions should be equal in status. This is formalized in 1931, and the Dominion's links to Britain become largely symbolic. Ghana's independence, 1957. The Gold Coast, now known as Ghana, gains independence from Britain. It is the first sub-Saharan African colony to gain independence. 1899, the Second Boer War. Britain fights a bitter war against self-governing Afrikaner or Boer colonies in Africa. The war introduces many modern industrial fighting methods, including the use of machine guns and concentration camps for civilians. Britain eventually wins the conflict. Declaration of 1947, Indian Independence. The Indian Independence Act is passed, creating modern-day India and Pakistan. The aim is to create two distinct states, one primarily Hindu and one Muslim. While the granting of independence is welcomed, Viceroy Mountbatten, his handling of it is criticized and results in outbreaks of violence. And now, Victoria Memorial Hall, Kolkata, 1921. When Queen Victoria passed away on January 22, 1901, the outpouring of grief was tremendous. She had reigned for 63 years, and at that time was the longest ruling British monarch. The impact of the Queen's death was felt not just in Britain, but across the British Empire. In Imperial India, the then Viceroy, Lord George Nathaniel Curzon, declared that a vast monument to the late Queen would be built, known as the Victoria Memorial Hall. This structure was designed by the celebrated architect William Emerson, also known for All Saints Cathedral in Allahabad. Curzon instructed Emerson that the memorial should be suitably stately, spacious, monumental, and grand. However, his plans went far beyond a mere monument to the late queen, and he also stated that the memorial should house a museum, a space where he decreed, quote, all classes shall learn the lessons of history, end quote. The foundation stone was laid by the Prince of Wales, the future King George V, in January of 1906. However, work would not begin until 1910. Due to numerous issues during construction, the monument was not open to the public until 1921. On January 24, 1989, UNESCO acknowledged the historic importance of the Victoria Memorial Hall by granting it the status of a World Heritage Site. Today, the Memorial Hall contains some 25 galleries and regularly welcomes thousands of visitors every year. Its collection relates not only to Queen Victoria, but also to British imperial rule in India between 1700 and 1900. The Victoria Memorial Hall stands as both a monument to Queen Victoria, but also as a conspicuous artifact of the British Empire. And here are some key features of the hall. Located at the south entrance is the monument to the Queen's successor, King Edward VII. The memorial arch contains a bronze statue of Edward, depicted mounted on his horse. The sculpture was by Sir Bertram McKennell, a renowned sculptor best remembered for designing the coinage for the reign of King George V. The building is 184 feet tall and occupies a 64-acre space. Its design, by William Emerson, is said to have mimicked the style of the Italian Renaissance. However, others state it purposely evokes the Taj Mahal. The hall is constructed out of white Makrana marble, brought from Rajasthan, the same substance used in the construction of the famous mausoleum. Located near the King Edward VII Memorial Arch is George Frampton's bronze bust of Queen Victoria. She's depicted in her later years, contrasting Thomas Brock's youthful portrayal, which adorns the interior of the hall. Victoria is also wearing the robes of the Order of the Star of India, a chivalric order implemented to honor Indian dignitaries following the suppression of the Indian Mutiny, 1857 to 58. Atop the central dome stands an impressive 16-foot bronze figure, the Angel of Victory. Surrounding the dome are several other sculptures representing charity, art, and architecture, among other concepts. The North Dome has a further series of statues representing ideas such as motherhood, learning, and prudence. Memorial Hall. This vast space is located under the central dome and includes Thomas Brock's huge statue of a young Queen Victoria. This appears to have been commissioned after George Frampton's bronze and was deemed unsuitable. This hall also has the Queen's pianoforte on display. This was the same piano with which Queen Victoria was tutored as a teenager and was gifted to the hall in 1905 by King Edward VII. The Queen's correspondence desk was also gifted to the hall by the King. And that, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining me for this journey through All About History. I hope you'll meet me here again next week, and we will pick up right where we left off and explore some more exciting articles from our past. I'm Ted Weil, wishing you all the best. Until next time.